morning, everyone. This is Kathy Mason from MasonWorks Marketing here on Conscious Business Zone with an esteemed guest today. We've got Dr. Jeffrey Mishlove, and Dr. Jeffrey is I'm so honored because I'm a huge fan of his work. He's an author. He's a TV personality, PBS TV personality, and he's the recipient of the only doctoral diploma in parapsychology, which we'll talk about, ever awarded by an accredited university, the University of California in Berkeley, of course, in Berkeley, in 1980. So he has been on this mystical journey to understand the unseen for 40 years, something like that. So Jeffrey, welcome, welcome.
Thank you, Kathy. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So Jeffrey, we're watching humanity wake up right now, and you've got to be excited because you've had your impact in all of that. How are you seeing what's happening right now?
Well, I suppose you could say it's a race to the finish line. Are we going to wake up before we destroy ourselves, or will we destroy ourselves before we wake up?
Do you think that we've always felt that? I mean, when you look at Plato and Socrates and the early mystics, they were always longing, Rumi, they're longing to be reconnected, and always thought that the human animal didn't quite get it. Do you think it's different now?
Well, the difference now is that we actually have the power to destroy all human life on this planet that in Plato's day we didn't have. In Newton's day we didn't have it, but today we do. So human nature perhaps hasn't changed much, if at all, and hopefully, our better angels will guide us and will avoid the catastrophic destiny that we seem to be headed towards. I mean, as far as I know, there are species of mammals, in fact, like us, that are dying every day.
Right, right.
Whole species.
Right. Well, I guess I'm hoping that we'll get to a little more optimistic side of this, because I feel like the internet has changed everything. In the past, you would have, when Ukraine would have happened, you might have started World War III. But with the internet and us all seeing each other and getting the sense of, well, they love their children too, there's been, I think, an awareness of the preciousness of life. And that comes from a higher mystical connection. Do you agree?
Well, I certainly agree that an awareness of the preciousness of consciousness comes from a higher spiritual connection. But I think the internet is a double-edged sword. It's a wonderful tool. I use it every day. And at the same time, I'm aware that it seems to be giving people who have a tendency towards arrogance, narcissism, anger, and overall negativity, it gives them a platform too. And that's also spreading. The internet is serving, you could say, as an amplifier of human nature, good and bad.
Right, right. So you're looking at this from having done PBS specials, PBS reporting, basically, for years. And so are you looking at that way of conveying information was simpler and more loving than the internet? Or how, I guess I just want to understand what you're saying a little bit.
Well, let me be clear. I've never worked for PBS.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I had a national public television series.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The original Thinking Aloud series.
Right.
We were out on the satellite, and we were carried by public television stations all across North America. The show ran for 15 years, but it was never part of PBS National Public Television. It was always sort of a private venture that worked out through the satellites. But in any case, we were carried. We were on broadcast television, so that was nice. And it's not as if the human race didn't have problems 20, 30, 40 years ago, but it does seem that things have gotten nastier since then. Things are also on the other side, let's put it this way, more extreme. The good is getting better. The bad side of life is getting nastier. And, you can see it in our politics, but just in the way that people behave towards each other, the rudeness of people being willing to troll or to post nasty comments on the internet, I think is quite strong. People would say things to each other on the internet that they would never say in person.
Right, right. Well, I think part of this lockdown period has been the opportunity for us to look at what we're saying to ourselves as well. That self-talk is where all of it's coming from, because they're just projecting that out. The thing that I'm excited about learning from you is your quest into the mystical relationship that we have with our soul, and whether or not it goes, it's from reincarnation, life after life, or whether it is this time and space. And so could you talk a little bit about your, I know I read part of your thesis that was for the Bigelow Institute. And it was brilliant. And everyone, I'll put the link so you can actually get your own copy of it. It's on a website and you can download it. It's 95 pages or over 90 pages long. So it's like a book, actually. It's brilliant. And there's videos embedded in it. It's fabulous. No wonder why you won. We'll talk about that. But let's talk about your journey, because you were studying criminal psychology, and then you went to parapsychology. So could you explain that journey and what parapsychology meant to you at that time?
Happy to do it, sure.
Okay, thank you.
I do have a master's degree in criminology, and if you had known me in 1972, you would have seen me at the psychiatric unit of San Quentin Prison conducting group therapy sessions with murderers and rapists. That's what my life was about at the time, when I had the most powerful dream of my entire life. I remember it vividly today, 50 years later. And in this dream, my Uncle Harry, my great Uncle Harry, came to me in the dream. He was 50 years older than me and when he died. And he talked to me about my life, and it was a deep soul-to-soul connection. That's the best way I can describe it, because when I awoke from that dream, I was crying tears of joy and singing a very sacred song from the Jewish religious tradition, Avinu Malkeinu, for those who might know. And I wrote home. I said, "How's Uncle Harry? I had a dream about him." My mother called me as soon as she got my letter and said, "How did you know Uncle Harry had just died?"
Yeah.
Well, that sort of shook me up. So I said, "Well, could I have an object that belonged to him as a memento, something to remember him by?" And I was sent a little book, a small, thick book, and it was written in Yiddish, and I had to have it translated. But I learned then that my Uncle Harry was a mystic. This was I was told it was his favorite book, and it was called The Tales of the Baal Shem Tov, who is the founder of the Jewish, it's called the Hasidic tradition in Judaism, which is a very mystical tradition that goes back to the 16th, 17th centuries in Europe, 18th century. And that was the first inkling that I had in my own family, a tradition of mysticism. And it made me think that I ought to shift the whole focus of my academic work, because I love to study human deviance. However, you could think of the human deviance in terms of both positive and negative. And I had immersed myself in crime and in psychopathology, but I thought at this point it was time to shift to the positive forms of human deviance, meaning creativity, intuition, mysticism, psychic functioning, life after death. And I agonized over this for months. How do you do this at the University of California, where I was, one of the world's great universities, but at the same time, they didn't offer programs in any of the topics that interested me the most. So after months and months of trying to figure out a solution, one pointed focus, one day, Kathy, I had a sense, an intuition, that the answer was going to come that night in a dream.
Oh.
Yeah, another dream. It seems as if these two dreams really affected my life incredibly, because I did. I had this dream. It seemed like a very prosaic dream. I was visiting friends, knocked on the door of their apartment. Nobody answered. I found a key. I let myself into their apartment. And there, in the middle of the living room floor, I saw a magazine in my dream. It was called EYE.
Oh.
And as I paged through it in the dream, I woke up with this feeling of exhilaration. Like, I have it, eureka, I have the answer, but I hadn't a clue what the answer was. So I acted out the dream. I just put on my tennis shoes, ran across town 5 miles, came to this apartment where my friends lived, knocked on the door, and as I had dreamt, no answer. And I happened to know that they kept a key under the doormat. So I grabbed the key, let myself into their apartment, something I wouldn't normally do, and in the middle of the living room floor, just as I had dreamt, was a magazine. And I picked it up. It was not called I, it was called Focus. And that magazine literally brought focus to my life. It was the magazine of listener-sponsored radio and television in the San Francisco Bay Area, KQED. And as I paged through it, it dawned on me I could pursue my interests by getting involved in the non-commercial sector of the media, which was a huge shift for me, because at the time I was like this long-haired hippie character. I didn't own a radio or a television. And furthermore, I didn't believe in them. I believed that the only authentic human interactions were face-to-face. Electronic media was phony baloney. But at that moment, I changed my mind. And I went right away over to KPFA Radio, it's Pacifica Network, another nonprofit listener-sponsored radio network, and they had a station there in Berkeley. And I said, I'm here to volunteer. And they said, good. Even though I had a master's degree by then, they said, sit at this desk. And when you hear the doorbell ring, push this button and let people in the front door. So I happily took that job. And within 3 weeks, I had learned how to produce a radio show. In fact, I produced one, and it was about you don't have to be from out of town to be psychic. And I was interviewing my friends in Berkeley, and the program director liked it so much that he said, well, we have a regular slot for you every Tuesday and Thursday at noon. Would you host this interview program called The Mind's Ear? And so all of a sudden, within a few weeks of my dream, I found myself sitting across a table face to face with world-class experts in all the fields that interested me the most, with 10,000 people listening in.
Wow, that's so exciting, because I think what you're saying, you number one had a prophetic, you had several, you connected with your uncle, and then it just led you to be more and more open. So your search, it's like a fire in your belly, the craving to learn. That's what I call what I'm doing here, is that I just get so excited to talk to everybody because I feel like a sponge. Did you feel about the same way about that?
I still do.
Yeah.
Hasn't gone away for half a century. I just love this field. I love talking to people in it. I love soaking up as much information. And I honestly think, Kathy, if you run into me 10,000 years from now, I'll be the same. We'll have the same conversation. So much to learn.
Right.
It was at this point when I found myself, you know, face to face with the most interesting people I could imagine, people like Robert Monroe, author of Journeys Out of the Body, for example, that I went back to the university and took advantage of a very obscure rule that they had, that if, number one, you're already a graduate student in good standing, and you want to write a dissertation on a topic that no single department at the university will sponsor, but you can find three faculty members from different departments who will sponsor you, you can create your own unique, individual, interdisciplinary doctoral major. So that's what I did in parapsychology. And that's why I have such a unique degree. But at the same time, I have to say there are hundreds of people around the world who do doctoral research in parapsychology. They just get their degrees with diplomas that say other things besides parapsychology on them.
And so how did you even call it that? Because you're at the cutting edge. I mean, this is 1980.
Yeah.
So 1980, you're a long hippie with hair. and a lot of the videos I've watched, you have hair from then. Yeah. You have these spiritually transformative, informative experiences. And then you start hearing about everyone else's experiences. Was that back, well, you're in Berkeley, so was that a lot of drugs? Was that LSD and all of that, or was it more spiritual?
Well, to be honest, I grew up in the Midwest in Wisconsin. I did my undergraduate work at the University of Wisconsin, and that's where I was first exposed to marijuana and psychedelics. So yeah, I had an involvement with all of that. In fact, even as an undergraduate, I wrote a senior honors thesis on the psychology of religious mysticism. Mm-hmm. And I had gone into that project as a skeptic, with the idea that, oh, there is obviously some form of psychopathology involved in people who see ghosts or report mystical experiences. And I'll write that up. That'll be my project, to explore that. But the deeper I got into it, even as an undergraduate, I realized that mystical people are some of the most highly functional people in our society.
That's, yep.
As a matter of fact.
Well, and, What I'm fascinated with is how open you are to listening, and not you've heard more things than I've studied. And just by talking to some of these incredible minds, but you're very open-minded. It's not like you've got your worldview and you're putting everything into your worldview. You can tell when you're interviewing and you're asking people, you're pulling out their core essence, their gift, and sharing it without judgment, without any ego, from your presentation. You're giving them a platform. And I just honor that so much. I want to be like you when I grow up.
Well, thank you, Kathy.
Well, so okay, parapsychology was the term in existence, or did you create the term?
Well, the term actually, I think, goes back to the 19th century, but it was popularized primarily by J.B. Rhine at Duke University in the 1930s. Oh. And he popularized the terms parapsychology, extrasensory perception. ESP is another term associated with Rhine. Most people would say that J.B. Rhine, working at Duke University in the 1930s, was the father of modern scientific parapsychology. Wow. He was one of the founders of the Parapsychological Association. He's the one who first did these card guessing experiments.
Oh, okay.
So well known, and he became a world famous scientist. And yet at the same time, the opposition was just enormous. And in spite of the fact that he did excellent work, and excellent work has been going on now, I guess you'd have to say, for nearly 100 years, experimental work and field studies go back even earlier than that to the Society for Psychical Research, which was founded in England in 1882. So the field has a long history. It has extensive documentation, hundreds of research studies, and it's a very real academic discipline. It has been officially recognized by the American Association for the Advancement of Science. That occurred in 1969.
Okay, cool.
So, the shame of it is that after all of these years, I'm still the only person with a doctoral diploma that says parapsychology. The enormous social pressure for people. You could be a Nobel laureate, and as soon as you start to explore this well-documented field, people begin to shun you.
Right, right. And why do you think that is? Why do you think that there's, because I'm a volunteer for IONS, and I was amazed at the testimonials of some of the experiencers that they hid and did not articulate their near-death experience for 20, 30 years. I wasn't sure if it was they just didn't have the words, which is the feeling is one thing, the words are another.
Yeah.
That's one thing, but it's also the fear of being locked up or put on drugs, because they assume your personality is splintered.
Yeah. Well, we live in a very dark and materialistic age. One of my friends calls it the dark age of scientism, in which the culture as a whole, and in particular the elites in academia and in science, seem to feel that the materialistic, mechanistic worldview that works so well in science and technology for most purposes is a complete description of nature. And so anything that seems that it cannot be explained by materialism is suspect. And ironically, materialism can't even explain the simple fact that each of us is a conscious being.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing, because I have a huge fascination with all of this as well. And the whole thing is how could we not think that there's something unseen here? But that's my choice. The other part is that the construct that we live in prefers right now, I think it's changing, prefers that we go through someone else to have a mystical experience rather than us directly having a mystical experience. And sorry, that's not happening anymore. There's a lot of us.
Well, you know, back in the first, second century, there were people called Gnostics. Now, mm-hmm. The word Gnostics derives from our word of knowledge. And they believe that it's possible to have direct knowledge of supersensible worlds, direct knowledge of the divine. And the church suppressed it violently because they felt, no, you can't. It's a terrible thing to try and have direct knowledge. You've got to go through our priesthood. And that led to countless tragedies, as a matter of fact. And so the church became like a, after the Inquisition, the burning of witches, the imprisonment of Galileo, the church became an authoritarian, oppressive organization. And finally, in the Renaissance, science burst out. You know, we began to realize we can do science regardless of what the church says. And as a result, science became somewhat antagonistic to the spiritual values of religion. And this tension has existed for some time. Now, I know it's changing. I've watched it in my lifetime, and I can see that science is very, very slowly beginning to open. Sooner or later, the truth does win out. And for example, in 2018, just 4 years ago, the flagship journal of the American Psychological Association, an organization that has been among the most hostile to parapsychology because psychologists are the most threatened by parapsychology. They don't want to be considered, you know, woo-woo. Nevertheless, they published an article surveying some 1,400 different experiments in parapsychology and concluding that the research was done rigorously, conditions got tighter and tighter and tighter, and the research findings have held up. And furthermore, there are many, at least possible theories. There are many, let me put it this way, hypotheses by which we could explain psychic functioning within a scientific framework.
Perfect. Perfect. I have so many questions. I think I'm going to have to interview you more than once. because I think one of my questions is, who is your favorite person you ever interviewed on your show?
Well, there are so many. Usually my favorite person is the person I'm interviewing at the moment. but if I had to look back, one of the people who has been among the most influential for me is Jean Houston, who is a psychologist who was very instrumental early on in my career while I was still a student. These days, on New Thinking Aloud, one of our videos has been going viral with a good friend of mine, Stefan Schwartz, who is looking at the applications of remote viewing to look into the future. Precognition is one of the areas that parapsychologists study. It has enormous theoretical, metaphysical implications, but the research has held up over and over and over again. Yeah. And what it suggests, to put it in lay terms, is that the future has already happened.
Right. Well, so okay, so let's ask this then. Do you feel, from what you know, that the soul picks the storyline to have the human experience, the lifetime experience? It's predetermined to some level, or
Well, that's an idea that you get out of esoteric culture.
right.
One of my professors calls it parapsychological folklore. There's a lot of folklore that suggests that that is the case. And I know, however, if you talk to people who are having a miserable life and tell them, you chose this,
Yeah, it's not
they're not going to appreciate what you have to say. So I think it's very possible that that's the case, but you have to have an appreciation for ambiguity. You have to be willing to say, I don't know. It could be, but maybe not, that some things haven't yet been settled. And
Okay,
that would be one, but I'm certainly open to the idea.
well, all I was thinking is that your uncle, who knew you before you knew him, before you embodied, knew he would set you on this path, knew he would give you the mystical book, knew he would help implant that dream, or if you have angels or guides, and then it would set you on this whole trajectory that wasn't anything like what you were. I mean, you were in nonprofit land instead of, go out and make a living, which is what society wanted you to do. I mean, really, that's why I was asking, is do you feel like your life has been orchestrated from outside help?
I feel like if I had to write the script for my life, it would have been hard to do a better job, which makes me think I did write the script. So yeah, intuitively I could say, yeah, I certainly feel that way. I've had a wonderful life. I can look back now for 50 years. Of course, there were struggles. There were times when I was anxious or unhappy or ill or felt attacked in one way or another. But as I look back, I think I've had one of the best lives. And it's still going. It's not over yet, but it's like one of the best lives anybody could possibly have.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I guess I just took a class, a six session class with Kelvin Chin, who has an afterlife series, and it was mind expanding. That's why I asked that question, is wow. I mean, you can wonder, 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 and the delight and the excitement of wondering all of it. There's a lot of lot of imagination possibilities of creating at a higher level by doing that.
But I'm aware of the fact that, not everybody feels so in love with life as I do. So many people feel that life is a terrible burden for them. And
Yeah. Well, the programming, again, it's the religious programming that heaven's there, you ascend there, you don't get to have any of the experience here. So, another question for you about multidimensionality, in because you've got so much material on the soul and our interaction with the soul, but how does multidimensionality fit into that?
well, I'm a big fan of hyperspace. Hyperspace is a mathematical way of talking about physical space over and above the three dimensions that we have. We have back, forth, right and left, up and down. Those are the three dimensions by which you can pinpoint wherever you are in space. However, mathematicians And physicists also suggest that there could be many, many other dimensions. David Hilbert, a great mathematician, talks about infinitely many dimensions of space in mathematics. That's known as Hilbert space. And it makes perfect sense to me that the three dimensions of space that we experience through our senses may not be all that there is. It's from a mathematical point of view, it makes sense to think that the three dimensions are embedded in higher dimensions. Well, in Einsteinian physics, it's four dimensions already because time is regarded as the fourth dimension. But then you've got fifth dimension, which is required, as I understand it, for the unification of electricity and magnetism. Oh. And then you get 6, 7, 8, 9. Superstring theory is up to 10, 11, 12 dimensions of space. So physicists are very comfortable with the idea of higher dimensions. And esoteric cultures, if you wonder, where was I when I was dreaming? Or if I had a near-death experience, where did that take place? It makes sense to me to think of these in terms of hyperspace. And I really suspect, I hypothesize, that the hyperspatial dimensions of mathematics and physics are very likely related to the higher spaces reported in parapsychology and in mystical thinking and in near-death experiences, lucid dreaming, etc.
Yes, perfect. I wanted to, because I know that I honestly need to talk to you more than once. I wanted to find out about your books. Because I want to make sure that people can see that not only I've been putting in the banner, I've been putting your YouTube channel, and you guys forget Netflix, just keep watching. you've got probably 6 months easy entertainment, Jeffrey. It's remarkable all of the work that you've done and that you've shared over the years. Thank you so much. But I want to also talk about your books, because the first book is like an encyclopedia, right? It's called Roots Consciousness Classic Encyclopedia Expanded. I had it in Amazon, and it looks like it's like reading the Encyclopedia Britannica on consciousness.
Well, that's actually the second edition you're looking at. The
first edition
of The Roots of Consciousness came out in 1975. And the subtitle then was Psychic Liberation Through History, Science, and Experience. So,
wow.
I was a big proponent of the idea that we should liberate our psyches.
Okay. And that is not easy reading, it sounds like. I mean, when I looked at that, it was like, oh, how could I even plow through
it's
this?
It's been my most popular book.
Really?
Okay. You can read it.
Okay.
You can get it for free. I posted it on the internet for free. You can buy copies, are still available, but the whole book is available online.
Oh, fantastic.
You just have to do a Google search.
Generous, my goodness. Okay, yeah. And then, okay, so you guys, as soon as I find the link, I will put it in the links so you guys can see it on Amazon or see where it is for free. But the other book, which I started like, I may have to buy this book, was The PK Man. And so, okay, first of all, I think you are a warrior. You're an incredible, the fact that you would come out with work like this in the timelines that you've been doing it, you are way ahead of all the rest of us. So could you talk about the PK Man? Because this guy had telekinesis skills that are off the charts and probably could be a government weapon.
he would have liked to have been used by the government. His name was Ted Owens. He called himself the PK Man. That stands for psychokinesis. PK is the parapsychological abbreviation for psychokinesis, which another word for mind over matter. And I studied him for 10 years from 1976 until he died in 1987.
Wow.
And he performed hundreds of demonstrations of his ability to control the weather, to influence UFO sightings, to cause lightning strikes, to influence hurricanes, volcanoes, tornadoes, power blackouts, large-scale effects. At the time, Uri Geller was attracting a lot of attention with his psychokinetic abilities to bend spoons. And Ted Owens said, you could just as easily influence large-scale systems as spoons and silverware. And so on. Now, I know every time I say Uri Geller's name, there will be a peanut gallery of people out there who claim that they know he's a fraud. And I don't claim that he never engages in fraudulent activity. I have no way of knowing that. But I'm confident that the work that was done under laboratory conditions with Geller, and including work I've witnessed myself, is quite valid.
So someone just wrote, do you think there are other macro PK people out there today?
Undeniably, there are, especially if you look at shamans in most cultures, practice, for example, rainmaking.
Right. That's what I thought of right away was that the indigenous, it seems like the indigenous got the memo and kept the memo. And we, the rest of us, the rest of the world is now waking up to how they know how to use the natural laws and the electric body. So Jeffrey, did you get interested in PK because you wanted those superpowers?
Well, I took Ted Owens' training course.
Oh, you did?
Yes. And the reason is because I had been ignoring him for a couple of years. He had not been so successful. And one day and Christmas Eve, 1985, I got a phone call from Ted Owens in which he said in his big booming voice, "Jeffrey, this is the most important phone call you will ever receive. You must contact the U.S. government and tell them not to launch that next space shuttle, because if they do, my UFOs are going to knock it right out of the sky." And I ignored it, of course. What am I to do? Call NASA and tell them that a psychic I'm working with warned them not to launch the space shuttle? I knew no one would listen to me. But when the Challenger exploded, this Challenger space shuttle, it shook me to my core, and I felt I should be paying more attention to this man. And so I took his training course. And when the course began, he said, "Well, Jeffrey, what do you want to do if you have these kinds of powers? How would you use them?" And I said, "Well, I have no intention of doing what you do. I'm not interested in creating, summoning UFOs or controlling the weather. What I'd like to do is to become an effective communicator to the world at large about the realities of psychic phenomenon and the esoteric world." And that's what has actually happened. Shortly after I took the training program, I launched the original Thinking Aloud series on television. And before you knew it, we were out on over 120 stations all across North America. So that has always been my purpose. And I think the lesson for people is this: you've got to get in touch with your own unique destiny. Yeah. Don't try to be somebody else. But when you try to become the best version of yourself, the universe will help you.
That's perfect advice. I would also say that you can tell, if you follow the energy, if you follow the excitement, it'll lead you to not the fear excitement, not the anticipation fear excitement, but the joy, like when you were a little kid and were playing, that excitement, that's what we're really here for. So cool. So you can probably still bust up a cloud though, right?
I've been occasionally, it seems, you have to be careful, because when I'm out under in a cloudy sky, I sometimes do that, but I haven't done a controlled scientific experiment. There, you have to be to have a healthy appreciation for human stupidity and human foolishness in this field. There's plenty of it. And so, sure, I think I probably do that. But at the same time, I wouldn't proclaim it publicly.
Yeah. Okay. So, okay, we'll censor this part. So how do you discern what's true? Because you've probably heard some outrageous things. How do you go with your heart or your gut, or how can you, especially before you interviewed a new person and they're making unusual claims, how did you vet them?
Well, it's different in every case. Because I've personally experienced so much over the years, I do have an open mind in terms of what is possible. I think that very often in the field of parapsychology, there are things that are just so bizarre that people can't believe them because of that. They're crossing the boggle threshold. Well, my boggle threshold has been crossed many, many times. So I'm very open to things that other people would have a hard time with, and I understand that. But once you've experienced it enough, then you can understand it too. And take, for example, UFOs. For decades, the U.S. government was trying to debunk UFO reports. Well, now finally they admit they're real. So that's an example of something that, cross the boggle threshold for many people, but now we have to take it seriously. The best test for these things is the scientific method when it's possible to apply it. And parapsychologists, by and large, are adherents to the scientific method. And one of the ways that we can feel confident about the existence of extrasensory perception and psychokinesis and precognition, for example, is that there have been well over 1,000 scientific studies under double-blind, well-controlled conditions. Parapsychologists, as a rule, are much more rigorous about the scientific methodology than other areas of the behavioral sciences. Right. So I'm confident that the people who do parapsychological research are careful and smart.
Yes, and I think we're just beginning to understand why this planet's one of the greatest shows on Earth, in the universe, and there's so many UFOs here and other beings watching us, because we're so much more powerful than we know.
I totally subscribe to that. But let me just say that when people come to me and they say, well, you're a parapsychologist, you believe in ESP and PK, and you know how the mainstream culture suppresses it, why don't you accept my conspiracy theory or my wild scientific ideas? And usually I respond and say, well, when those fields can reach the accomplishments of parapsychology and psychical research, which is 150 years of data under peer-reviewed, double-blind, controlled conditions, then I'd be happy to accept the data of your pet field or pet theory.
Right, right. Well, I think that as we're evolving, the computers are capable of looking at And calculating data so much higher that we're going to be discovering more and more and more. And in my worldview, the soul is projecting this vessel out from higher frequency and projecting the physical, the material world. So the game is how clear and clean can I get that projection to hold more light here, right?
Well, the problem is we're in a human body.
Right.
And our nervous system is vast. There are apparently many more neural connections within the human brain than there are subatomic particles, I have heard, within the whole universe. It's a funny thing about mathematics that can happen. But at the same time, if we were to open ourselves up to the fullness of consciousness while we burn out all our circuits, and so people can only sustain, I think, moments of complete cosmic consciousness, total mystical awareness for brief periods of time. It's very rare that an individual can maintain a state of cosmic consciousness and at the same time go about their life and handle the daily business of living. Our bodies are designed for survival in the physical plane. And the truth is, from remote viewing, we know there's no limits to the ability of the human mind to access information anywhere in time and space.
So
it's a kind of paradox that is, at the same time we are cosmic beings, we are also mortal animals.
That's right. And the other part of this is that there's 8 billion of these soul expressions that are on this planet right now. I mean, it's huge population explosion that all wanted to be here during this great awakening time. And so this is what, I mean, this is an incredible opportunity for the expansion of consciousness, because we're on the cutting edge in this dimension.
Well, I can well imagine that if I were from an advanced civilization on the other side of the galaxy, I would be very interested in what is happening on this planet right now. And I'm inclined to think that they're probably watching us because of the fact that we're at such a crucial stage, that when a civilization reaches the point where it has the capability of destroying itself, how long does it last? And there's something in astronomy known as the Fermi paradox, which is considering that there are so many potential planets in our galaxy that could host an intelligent civilization such as ours. Why aren't we receiving radio and TV signals from them? And the solution that many scientists have come up with is because once another civilization gets that power to send out radio signals, they very shortly end up destroying themselves. We're at that precipice now, and maybe the human race will turn out to be the one in a million civilizations that gets past this huge obstacle course that we're facing. Maybe we will. I mean, there are many positive things to be said about a human on planet Earth, but maybe we won't. Maybe we'll go the way of the dinosaurs.
I think we will, because I think that's why there's so many of us. There's never, I mean, there's a lot of beings, whether they were animals before and they decided to be a human this time, or there's a lot of beings here that wanted to be here exactly at this time to help uplift. And if you talk to a lot of the near-death experience community, they all have had mystical experiences. One of them is Reverend Peter Panagore, and he talks about, he studied a lot of mystics, and can quote them one by one. And he was talking to me about the added opportunity to reconnect with mysticism from all the people that have been resuscitated, that have died in for the past 40 years, have been taken to the hospital, and they automatically try to save people's lives. And maybe some people may not have reconnected to that dream or that experience, but Peter thinks that they will. And then that'll be the tipping point for humanity to reconnect to its mysticism. What do you think about that?
Well, I'm hesitant to be too optimistic. I know you're an optimist, and I'm very optimistic personally about my life. But let's face it, many civilizations have come and gone. Many species have come and gone. Consciousness itself will persist.
Right.
What the human race could go extinct, you and I will still be there as conscious beings. We may have to take on different bodies, different kinds of life forms.
Yeah.
If that happens.
And that's okay. I think I've done that many times. So yeah, I'm good with that. Well, okay. So let's go, since we're, I want to make sure that we talk a little bit about IONS, because you are a keynote this year. So I was going to pull up the IONS website so you could speak to it. So I'll be right back while I do that. Okay.
Okay. So she's pulling up the IONS website, and I'll just be patient. There we go. Energize. There it is. There it is. I'm going to be in Salt Lake. I don't know if my audio is on, but I can see it there. It's going to be a wonderful conference from August 31st to September 4th. And if any of your viewers are scientific researchers looking into the afterlife, this will be the place to be in Salt Lake City in less than a month from now.
Well, I want you to explain partly what you're going to be talking about, because you won one of the most prestigious awards that's available as the Bigelow Institute winner. Do you want to talk a little bit about that so that people know that what a great resource you are? I think I'm expressing that, but I want to make sure that.
Well, yes, I won the grand prize at the Bigelow Essay Competition. It was huge. I won $500,000. Some people call it the biggest essay competition ever to answer the deepest question ever. So and that's what I'm going to be talking about, evidence for human post-mortem survival. One line of evidence is, in fact, the near-death experience, but there are many. I have in my essay 9 different arrows or lines of evidence, each of which points toward human post-mortem survival. And when you take them all as a whole, then I argued that what you have is evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. It's not just near-death experience. It's reincarnation research. It's research with mediums. It's studies of possession. It includes something called instrumental transcommunication, which is there are tens of thousands of hobbyists who are communicating with deceased loved ones via electronic means, radios and televisions and computers and strange devices called, for example, the ghost box. There's some merit to all of these different fields, and I'll be surveying that in the presentation that I give there in Salt Lake.
Well, and I want to make sure that I do a good job of, I'll put all the links so everyone that watches this now and watches the replay has the opportunity to experience your life's work. It's just genius. It's just amazing. And I just want to say how grateful I am that I discovered it and that I can learn from you because it's grounded information. This is, you know, you have the woo-woo crystal ball stuff, which I like that stuff too. I'm not saying I don't like all of it, but I think the linear progression that you present brings everyone on board. It's not, you don't have to believe anything. You just have to be open.
Well, thank you, Kathy.
Yes. Okay, so Jeffrey, we're got to wrap up. I wish we'll do this again, I hope. I just am so, so honored to have had you here. How's the best way for everyone to connect with you? I've been putting your banner and I've been putting it in chat, but would you share how people can connect with you?
Well, there are two main ways that you had on your banner. The YouTube channel is New Thinking Aloud, and you can just go to New Thinking Aloud. It's all one word if you type it in, and it's Aloud is Allowed. NewThinkingAloud.com takes you to the YouTube channel where there are some 1,500 different interviews that I've posted there. Or you can go to our foundation, the New Thinking Aloud Foundation is newthinkingaloud.org. And you can sign up. We have a weekly newsletter. It's free. It has jam-packed full of information. And we also have at the Foundation website, a searchable database. So if you're interested in a particular topic, let's say poltergeists or remote viewing, well, that's a broad one. But in any case, you enter your search term in our database, it will take you to the exact spot in each our videos, as well as the videos of several other relevant organizations where your search term is mentioned. So those are both great resources.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So everyone, I hope this has been an eye-opener, and that my hope is that this is a resource that will help you live a happier life, be self-actualized in your power. Because we are much more powerful than we know. And this is another road to experiencing that and being part of the change. Thank you. Thank you, Jeffrey. I look forward to meeting you in person.
Yes, we'll see each other in person in less than a month.
Thank you all. Thank you so much. Please share. Thank you.